Okay, let's change gears then, and we're going to talk about barriers. And as a way of starting that conversation, I want to do a survey, the survey that I didn't get time to do at the end of yesterday. And I'm going to give you 8 options, and please don't make a choice until I have listed all 8. This is with regard to outrage management. Oh, that's too big. Let me use this one. This is with regard to outrage management generically, okay? And I'm going to give you 8 options. Number one, you don't buy it. Okay? You know, interesting day, but you think this is crazy. Okay? I'll get paid anyway, so that'll be all right. Number two is you're doing it already. Rio Tinto has a world-famous communities program. You've been tinkering with outrage management for years. You like it. You buy it. But, you know, you wonder why I keep saying it's counterintuitive, it's counternormative, it goes against your own outrage, it goes against your culture, where you feel like it is your culture. And pretty much what I've been recommending all day yesterday is what you're already doing. Okay. Number three, not my job. Okay. You buy it for somebody else. But you're not sure why you're here, because outrage management is not something you have to do very often. Number four is not needed here. Maybe some operations in Rio Tinto have an outrage problem, but you don't. Your organization doesn't. And, you know, you're glad those other poor bastards are learning this stuff, but, you know, you haven't got any use for it. Number five is you need more training. You know, a day's lecture and then a day's practice is not nearly enough. You don't feel ready to use these tools. You're intrigued. You like what you're hearing. But you need some kind of follow-up seminar. You know, you need some kind of additional training for you, for yourselves. Number six is others need training. Okay, you get it, okay. But the people back home aren't going to get it. And they're until they have had similar training, it's going to be very hard to use this stuff. So, you know, you're looking for who's local, who's in Australia that can come in and do a follow-up training. Not for you. You got enough. Who can do a follow-up training for the people, where you work who haven't been through these 2 days? Number seven is cultural barriers. It's good stuff, and you get it, and you don't really need more training. You know, more is always better, but you think you understand these principles, and you think they would work, but you are very worried that they will be hard to put into practice within the culture of your organization, whether you're thinking the Rio Tinto culture at large or the smaller culture of your corner of Rio Tinto. You have some sense that this will be hard to do because of organizational barriers, barriers in the culture of your organization. And finally, number eight, ready to roll. Now, I'm going to let you vote for two. Okay, so if you're torn, if you're torn 6 ways, you're still going to have to make choices. But if you're torn between two, if you feel like, well, you're kind of ready to roll, but there are cultural barriers, or it's not, you do need more training, but the real problem is others need more training, whatever. If you want to vote for two of them, you can. Okay. Everybody know how they're going to vote? Do we need to make this a secret ballot? No. Okay. All right. Raise your hand if you want to vote for number one. You don't think outrage management is the way to go. You don't buy it. Okay. No hands. You know, those are the people who will come out of the woodwork after I'm gone. You're doing this already. It's good stuff, but why do I think it's so novel? You've been doing it for a long time. You're already doing outrage management. Two on my side. Four. It's not my job. Good stuff, but not for me, thank God. Nobody. Not needed here. We don't face a lot of outrage. I'll keep this in mind in case people start getting pissed off. Nobody. I need more training. Day or two is not enough.
About eight.
Six for me.
Eight.
14. Other people need more training. We got to do something for the folks back home.
About 16.
15, all right, 31. There are cultural barriers. This is going to be hard to implement because, you know, there are problems in our culture.
I think 15.
13 is 15 and 13 is 28. I'm ready to roll. I'm good to go. Slowly rising. I'm sort of half ready to roll. Let's try that again. I'm ready to roll.
Put them up high.
With enthusiasm. I'm really, oh boy, they're, now they're coming up. Okay, I mean, I don't know what this means. I'm not going to publish it, but I like to do this at the end of a day like yesterday to get a sense of how people feel. And obviously, you know, there's a clear pattern here. The dominant things for you are your sense that your colleagues need training, and we might talk at the end of the day about, you know, sort of next steps, what it would take to make that kind of training happen. And the other big one, which we're going to be talking about in just a couple of minutes, is cultural barriers. There are also a sizable number of people ready to roll and a sizable number of people who think they need more training, that this was a good intro, but they're looking for something longer, for something deeper, you know, for something that would improve their readiness to move. So you got a lot of, you know, you got a significant 5 and 8. You got a whole lot of 6 and 7. You have very few people who think they're doing it already and nobody who's willing to own that they think it's stupid or it's not their job or they don't think they need it. This is not a universal pattern. I get real variation from group to group when I do this. My sense is that a high number of people who pick cultural barriers is a good sign. Okay? Because I think there are cultural barriers, and organizations don't differ in whether there are cultural barriers. They differ in whether they're aware of them and thinking about how to circumvent them and how to cope with them rather than blundering into them. So I think it's a very optimistic sign when a lot of people think there are barriers. I also think that the more people who think they do it already, the less optimistic I am. I mean, there's always, of course, the possibility that there are people who are doing it already. But when I, you know, when I talk to a room full of people and it turns out that 40 or 50% of them at the end of a day think they're doing it already, I know they don't quite know what it is, or that number would have been lower. And I mean, it's a sort of a continual frustration for me to interact with people who will say, oh, yeah, I've been using your stuff for years. And then I look at what they're doing and I think, oh, shit, if they think they've been using my stuff for years, you know, we're all in trouble.
Yeah, but Peter, with four, and given some of the people we know in the room already from previous experience and stories they've told us, four seems like a perfectly reasonable number.
Absolutely.
Probably a few more of them are actually doing it already, but aren't sure that they are.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, there are in every organization, and certainly in one like this that has the kind of sophisticated communities program you have, there are people who are doing it already. But if there are a lot of people who think they're doing it already, that's a bad sign. So, I mean, these are very encouraging numbers to me. I want to, very quickly, before we take the break, I want to just identify what I consider a couple of big organizational issues and cultural issues. Some of them were raised in your groups, but they weren't raised in our discussion. And some of them, at least, I didn't see or here raised in the groups, and I just wanted to name them. One that I've talked about a little bit already, and I just want to mention it because I think it is the single biggest one, is outrage management arouses internal outrage. You know, it arouses it among employees, it arouses it among board members and senior managers. Nobody likes to see you being nice to the people that they would like to kill. In order to address that, you need to do outrage management on behalf of outrage management. And there are a couple of articles on my website under the general aegis of managing management outrage at outrage management, which talk about that. One of them talks particularly about using the seesaw. That if you say to a CEO, I have this great new strategy, if we're really nice to the people you hate, we can make a lot of money, you're getting on the wrong seat of the seesaw, and the CEO is quite likely to say, yeah, but I don't want to do that. Whereas if you come forward and say, there is a possibility of doing this and this and this and this, and it might make the traditional owners less unhappy, but, you know, it would be really unpleasant. Probably we don't want to go there. If you manage the seesaw well, you can get senior management to tell you to watch out for the bottom line and make money for the company by doing these unpleasant things. Everybody understand what I'm talking about? So managing management outrage means you do internal outrage management. You stake out the middle. You acknowledge prior misbehavior. You acknowledge current problems. You share control. You give credit. All the things that we talked about yesterday. It would be a great shame if you wind up really good at managing external outrage and not apply those same tools to managing internal outrage at the fact that you're managing external outrage. So I think that's a key cultural barrier. A second one that I think didn't come up, or it came up just slightly in this conversation, is the risk-benefit trade-offs of outrage management. People get it that some kinds of behavior is rewarded and some kinds of behavior are punished. Let's play with some arbitrary numbers. Let's assume in some situation, if you manage it the conventional way, you have a 30% chance of success and a 70% chance of never being able to open the mine. If you manage it using outrage management, you have a 70% chance of success and a 30% chance of not being able to open the mine. So outrage management almost more than doubles the probability of success. Okay, terrific. However, let's assume that if you do it the traditional way and succeed, everybody's very proud of you. If you do it the traditional way and fail, nobody's mad at you because the traditional way often fails. It's those stupid stakeholders. It's a disaster for the company, but it's no problem for your career. By contrast, if you do outrage management and succeed, people say, well, see, we got our mine. Why did you have to do all these unpleasant things? It's like you were snapping your fingers to keep away the elephants. Obviously, there were no elephants, and you were wasting time and wasting money. If you do outrage management and fail, everyone says, well, that's why we didn't get the mine. It's because you were doing these crazy, innovative things. Okay. Does that make sense to you? If that's what happens, then, given that hypothesis, outrage management, this is a kind of a tragedy of the commons. Outrage management is good for the company, but it isn't good for anybody's career. And nobody's going to do it because people are smart about their careers and they, you know, they understand. So the question is, do innovative strategies get punished when they fail? Okay. Do innovative strategies get rewarded when they succeed? And are they more punished and less rewarded than conventional strategies? If so, you're not going to get much innovation. Okay. That's a cultural barrier that I see again and again and again. I'm seeing a lot of nodding faces like you're worried about that one, too. There are senior people in this room who can change the payoff matrix in ways that make outrage management a good career move. And you need to do that if you expect it to happen. You want to make a comment?
Yeah, I do. That's interesting because is there any quantifiable evidence where you've actually introduced the outrage management to speed up an approval process rather than traditional steady as she goes type of process?
Lots of evidence and lots of anecdotal evidence. And no quantitative evidence. I think it is difficult but not impossible to collect quantitative evidence. I haven't done it. I would love to see it done. And you could do it within the company, within Rio Tinto, and start trying to quantify in the way that Bruce quantified the benefit of doing good outrage management at Kintyre. You know, you could do that in a systematic way, and I think collect the kind of data that the techies respect. But remember, if they're outraged, it's not going to help because data doesn't affect outrage. You know, if you're talking to somebody who hates the idea of doing outrage management, all the data in the world that outrage management works, they will find a way to trash your methodology and say, no, it doesn't work because they don't want it to work. So you have to manage the outrage as well as collect the data.
Peter, we're doing something similar to that at the moment in terms of data collection with Harvard. And what we're doing is looking at, okay, what are the costs of it? So can we collect incidents of community conflict? What are the costs associated with that? What are the type of costs? What's the magnitude of them? That kind of thing. So we're collecting data on that, and they're much bigger than you think. Even we, expecting they would be big, but we're surprised about that. Data's difficult to find, but that's what we're trying to do. It's kind of the opposite of what you're saying. It's not what you can say, it's what you can do.
So you're going to have a book like this one that you just came out with. Everybody see this book? You have copies still available?
Yeah,
there's a few more. Okay. You're going to have one called Outrage Management Impacts. I mean, that would be priceless. I mean, an awful lot of people would like to see data showing that, you know, showing quantitatively how much money these kinds of processes can save. Basically, how much money outrage pisses away and outrage management can save. Incredibly valuable, but not as valuable as you think. Okay, I mean, incredibly valuable, but if people don't like outrage management, they will find a way to reject the data. I want to make one more point, and then we'll take the break. It was made in several groups, but it wasn't made en masse, and that is metrics. We do what we measure, and you know what the metrics are in your organization. Are they quarterly reports? Are they annual evaluations? Are they planning documents? Are they the 360 assessment document? Whatever it is. You know, I mean, if every 3 months you write a plan for what you're going to do for the next 3 months or on what you have done in the last 3 months, you write a report, and there's a half page saying, so what have you done in outrage management? And what are you going to do in outrage management? You look at that half page and you think, oh, shit, I better think of something to do. And I better do more in the next 3 months than I did in the last 3 months. So getting it into the documentation, getting it into the plan, getting it into the metrics of your organization, not new metrics, into the ones that already exist, I think is a very powerful tool of cultural change. Those are three that didn't get mentioned that I wanted to put on the table before we stopped.